The opinions expressed on the following audio program are solely those of the host and the guests. Byrna Podcast is an independently produced, not-for-profit show and is not associated with the Burning Man organization or its subsidiaries. The views expressed are not representative of the entire Burning Man community and are presented here for entertainment purposes only. In short, calm the fuck down. It's just a podcast.
All right. It's episode number. What episode is this? Episode 31. It's episode number 31. I knew that. I did not need to look that up. It is 185 days until the man burns as of this recording. And you are probably noticing, if you are a regular listener to the show, that my voice is fucked up yet again. This time I did not cause damage to myself through too much partying. I swear it's not what happened. There's a bug going around San Diego that a lot of people have caught on, but I was so proud of myself. Like, I didn't catch anything. I've been on top of it. I've been feeling great. And then the other night, I ended up having some heavy energy work done with my good friend Edward, he who runs the Story Consortium here in San Diego and runs our men's council, where a bunch of us guys get together and pour our feelings out. A really amazing individual, healer. So honored to have him in my life. And he spent an hour and a half just really working me over on Sunday night. And I was feeling a little bit like the bug was in my system, but I was really proud of myself for not being sick. And then after this hour and a half intense session, my voice totally, completely went. Like, the next morning, I could not speak. And I'm so sorry, dear listener, if those of you who are horrified to hear my downward spiral into all kinds of hippie woo-woo bullshit. But man, I am feeling more focused and more energetic and just more on top of being human than I have ever felt before. I'm feeling connected to spirit more than I ever have before. It's been a really amazing couple of months. And having this energy work done, I never thought it could be so powerful, but it really was. I'm fully tuned in to whatever this frequency is at this point, and I'm going to go further down that rabbit hole. I promise you, it's not going to take up all of the conversation all the time on this show if you're a regular listener and you are irritated by this, but it's been a pretty amazing couple of months. Very exciting, and I hope to get into it in heavy detail in a coming episode with the proper guest. We'll call it the hippie woo-woo episode. We're going to get back to that. It'll be interesting. This time I'm fully on board. But anyway, you guys know, a couple of weeks ago, music editor Navjeet and I were in San Francisco, had an amazing, amazing time up there. I got to meditate in Dolores Park, got to really, really have an amazing weekend. And Friday, I spent a lot of time over at Burning Man headquarters and interviewed Iris and Steven Raspa, and really was an amazing, amazing weekend. Thursday, I was staying a couple of nights with my good friend Pez, who you're going to meet very shortly on this show. Pez lives in the Mission District, and he's just like a block away from Burning Man headquarters, so it was really perfect. And in the morning on Thursday, my interviews and everything had gotten pushed because we have to go through all this like media approval stuff with HQ in order to get the guests on, in order to have people speak on behalf of Burning Man. You know, it's a protocol. It's a process. There's a bureaucracy. You know, people have meetings and all this other stuff. Anyway, I spent the day traveling around San Francisco on my own. But in the morning, Pez took me into his office briefly so that I could kind of see what he does. And they're doing some amazing shit. Some truly amazing future of society type stuff, which is what I continue to find with our amazing community. Everybody just keeps doing more and more amazing shit. That's why we started this show, in order to tell you these stories. And it was perfect because as the day went on and I was exploring the city, I texted Mike Pez and I said, "Hey, dude, how do you feel about doing a podcast about what you guys are doing here?" And he checked in and with the CTO, who you'll also meet very briefly. And they said, "Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it." And very exciting. So I got to sit down with the two wonderful gentlemen that you're about to meet. Matthew Goodman, who is the CTO, the Chief Technology Officer of 3Scan. That's the company that you're going to be learning about right now. And Mike Pesavento, aka Pez, my very good friend. His official title is Datamancer. That's a fucking cool title, man. But and these are a couple of the guys that are making the company that you're about to learn about, called 3Scan, move forward. And they're doing some amazing shit with it's a microscope technology. You know what? I'm not going to really get into the details of what they're doing, but the technology that they're working on is really at the forefront of their field. And the part about it that really caught my attention was Pez showed me a mouse gut. I mean, if you can imagine how tiny a mouse gut is, it's about the size of the top of your pinky, maybe, if that. And the microscope technology that they have reverse engineers basically organic matter, and it cuts through it and it recreates a three-dimensional design of that organic matter. And in this case, it was the mouse gut, which is what Pez was showing me. And this 3D representation of the mouse gut is so detailed that it is terabytes of information. And it's so big that you could theoretically throw on Oculus Rift headset and walk into the mouse gut and look at it from the inside. Theoretically, I'm not sure if they've actually done that, but it's that big and it's that detailed and it's that perfect. So this is really, truly futuristic technology. And it was, a lot of people are very excited about this episode. Like, I've told multiple people about this particular show, and people who are not even burners, like artist friends of mine or just even scientist friends of mine, who are really curious. They want to learn a lot about what 3Scan is doing, and 3Scan is doing some really amazing stuff. It's a company predominantly populated by burners, and we're going to get into their company culture, their background, and then of course there's going to be some Playa stories. It's a pretty amazing show. I'm very excited to present to you today's episode. Anything else I need to tell you about it? No. Let's go ahead and get right into it. Today's episode is entitled Scientists in the Dust. Is that a cool name? I don't know if that's a cool name. Scientists in the Dust. Either way, you get the whatever. You get the idea. Scientists in the Dust. I go by Mr. Arash, even though nobody calls me Mr. Pardon my crazy, weird-sounding voice. On the actual episode, it won't sound like that, I swear. Welcome to Burner Podcast.
On the first part of the journey, I was looking at all the life. There were plants and birds and rocks and things. There were sand and hills and rain. The first thing I met was a fly with a buzz and the sky with no clouds. The heat was hot and the ground was dry, but the air was full of sound. I've been through the desert on a horse with no name. It felt good to be out of the rain. In the desert, you can't remember your name, cause there ain't no one for the kids.
Sit or pro?
Pro.
Okay. I mean, because either one is totally fine. But no, apparently a lot of major podcasts, like the thing that actually gave me the kick in the ass to just like start doing this was I heard Neil deGrasse Tyson's podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And it sounded terrible. Like, it was like...
He just rolls around and records random stuff.
Oh, man, you're like a huge... Like, my iPhone could sound better than that. But I don't know if it was just that one particular episode I heard or something, but... Maybe. Of course, like, with him, it's like the content is like... Right. You know, you can just spit on a cocktail napkin and we're all going to pay attention. So for the listeners, let's have each of you introduce yourselves, and I'm going to have you just go ahead and throw your dick on the table. and say what your titles are. By the way, you're okay with that?
Sure.
All right. Throw your dicks right on the table and tell me what your titles are, backgrounds are, and sort of like in a couple of sentences how you ended up to be here where we're sitting. Fire away.
I guess I'll start. My name is Matthew Goodman. I am the CTO of 3Scan. I got here actually as a result kind of indirectly of Burning Man, honestly. At least it figures into our origin story pretty closely.
Well, that's funny since this is called Burner Podcast.
So. Exactly.
How perfect.
Yeah, exactly. But I met my co-founders and a number of other people who were early and instrumental in this company through that whole social setting, and it continues to be a pretty big thing in my life. So,
what sort of background does one need in order to be a chief technology officer for a startup?
I don't know. I had an undergraduate and master's degree in material science, but apparently the thing that qualifies you here is dropping out of a PhD program, which I have also, which is a biomedical PhD I dropped out of at UT.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's just like a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. It was like a mixture of software, some knowledge of hardware, a little bit of electronics. It's kind of how it all came together.
Yeah. Beautiful. Mike?
Yeah. Hey, my name is Mike Pezzavento. A lot of my friends call me Pez. I was hired on to 3Scan about a year ago to help start up their image analysis portion of the company. My official title is Datamancer. My background is in computational neuroscience and biomedical engineering. I've done a lot of work in image processing, machine learning, signal processing kinds of jobs, and came across these guys through a lot of different social groups and found to be a great fit and dove in and been having a fun time since.
That's awesome. And so would one of you be able to say in one sentence what 3Scan does?
We build a specialized type of optical microscope that lets you image large volumes of tissue.
At high resolution.
At high resolutions.
And rapidly.
Fairly rapidly, yeah. So.
Does anybody else do this?
Not even close.
there's a lot of other technologies that have like some particular angle at which they're, you know, like slightly faster or slightly higher res, but this combines a lot of unique aspects that lets you do some unique things with it.
So like what stands out about this particular technology versus a lot of what else is on the market?
The big thing is you can really do like large blocks of tissue. A pretty common thing you do in the world of imaging tissue is you take some sort of serial sections, you stain them, put them on slides, and then look at them with your microscope. This kind of works, honestly. You can get a pretty good job of this if you have a fair degree of skill, but this allows, the technique we have allows you to do basically the whole block, kind of cleanly registered slice to slice, and really get some three-dimensional sorts of metrics out of it, which is not something you can really do with the traditional 2D approaches. Mm-hmm.
So what sorts of applications do we have? Like, is there like a real world example that you could provide for somebody who is not familiar with this particular industry that could say like, oh, there is something that I have personal experience with that came as a result of something 3Scan did or a company like it even?
Sure. I mean, so we do high throughput biological screening is another way to look at it. Mm-hmm. And classic histology looks at two-dimensional images, and you have a professional histologist look at that two-dimensional.
Histology
is the study of tissue.
Why do we study tissue?
Because when we look at tissue, at different types of tissue, we can look at the structural components of it, like are the cells healthy, are they not healthy, is it cancerous? So histology uses a couple different techniques, different kinds of stains that they can use to look at the tissue and identify different things about that tissue.
So does a histologist work like directly with the patient, or is it the background science that they're building that eventually ends up in the
It's the background science. Okay. They, for example, you could get a biopsy taken, right? And from that biopsy is taken to a histologist, and they look at that biopsy and take slices of it, and they look at the two-dimensional images of those slices and say, yes, I think it's a tumor.
Yeah. It's not a tumor. You have to make that joke whenever you say tumor.
And so that screening process takes a while to go through that, like collect the tissue, stain it, put it through, and look at a two-dimensional image, which does not have all of the information that you'd want to see to be able to identify what the thing is. Is it a tumor? Is it not a tumor? 3Scan is able to take tissue like that, stain it, put it through our system, and then look at the three-dimensional outputs. Mm. And looking at tissue, which is actually a three-dimensional thing, not two-dimensional, mm-hmm. gets you more information for what that thing actually is. Yeah. You can look at it three dimensions and more clearly say, yes, it's definitely a tumor. Say it's this big sphere of tissue that's grown that should not be there.
Yeah.
And if you're looking at it in 2D, it's a little bit harder to recognize that.
So now, let's say I go to my doctor and I have this abnormal growth and he wants to study it. Does he like send that over to you guys, or is this background research that's already been done before I even make it to the doctor?
So right now we're mainly doing the kind of background research aspect of it. There's a couple of facets to that. The first of all is that it's an unregulated market, meaning we can go and work with researchers in those areas and provide imagery and services without having to talk to the FDA or, you know, get doctors to believe what we're doing is really useful. Sure. They're both like fairly substantial problems, it turns out. From that, we're going to start moving into more like preclinical research type spaces mm-hmm. where it's human tissue and this technique is being used to help develop drugs or help you understand the effects of particular treatments. Mm-hmm. In the very long game, we'd like to be serving people in some capacity. So,
are you guys like kind of like, would it be like to be able to describe that you're building a database, if you will, that people can reach out towards and get information from?
Yeah, so one of the big goals of this technique is to provide like reference data sets that are tangible for people. Say like, this is what a healthy prostate looks like, you know, carefully dissected in three dimensions. This is what a healthy breast tissue looks like. This is what malignant, you name it, like liver looks like. There's all sorts of permutations of different cells out there and different sorts of things you'll encounter and see in them.
Yeah.
So
it's like a directory that you can use as a frame of reference.
Yeah. And what some of the earliest interests we got were actually in making like anatomical reference models. Mm-hmm. So some people who literally are writing textbooks were saying, hey, like, can you slice this up and give us five views of the same thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's something we can do.
Yeah. Yeah, because earlier, Mike, you were showing me, was it like a mouse
gut? It was the intestine. Yeah.
It was the mouse intestine. And so you've been able to scan that, and now like you can blow that up like on a wall if you wanted to, and like really just dig headfirst into that kind of stuff. Like, it's insane.
I mean, you're kind of joking when you say headfirst, but one of the things that I'm trying to play with is new ways to present this data. It's three-dimensional data most people don't know how to be looking at tissue in three dimensions. And of course, there's the advent of virtual reality and augmented reality, and there's a lot of different things that are coming up. One of the things that we're working on is taking these models, these three-dimensional models, and putting them into a virtual reality space. And then you can actually literally dive head first into these models and like swim through the intestine and look at the wall and say, oh yeah, that's the spot or whatever it is with the VR headset on.
It's just insane. It's, so a lot of this show, we started it, and I've talked about this multiple times, because a lot of the conversations that are being had in our community are really deciding what's going to happen in the next chapter of human civilization. And somehow these ideas are being cultivated, you know, with you wearing bunny ears and a dress in the desert. So can you guys talk a little bit about sort of like the culture of the company how this all came together?
I can tell a little bit of our creation myth, if that's relevant.
Fire away.
So I actually met my co-founders, co-founder Todd, quite a while ago. It was through kind of this bizarre, like, transhumanist journal club type circle thing.
Okay.
But I didn't really connect with him until I'd gone to Burning Man in 2009, at which point we... Transhumanist
what? Book club?
It was kind of like a study group, honestly.
Okay.
Really nerdy kids, even in nerdier interests.
Yeah.
And Todd had come to one of these.
I assure you, there's no shortage of them.
Oh, yeah, totally. So. But then I gotten to know him much better at Burning Man in 2009. Mm-hmm. By 2010, we had started a company together, and you know, the rest is kind of history. Mm-hmm. So actually, no, it was a couple years after that. How did that work out? Anyway, yeah, it was 2 years after that, I guess, now that I think about it. And we got to hang out a bit. I told him that I'd had a required externship as part of my PhD fellowship. Mm-hmm. He was like, of course, you should come out to San Francisco and, you know, work with us for a while. And I guess the joke is now it's like the 60th month of my summer internship or something like that. So that's kind of how it went.
What is it about, because this is like one of those things that I've been observing a lot about the culture as well, the Burning Man community, is that of course you have, I feel like you kind of have like your four groups of people. And I know I've said this on multiple episodes. Yeah, four archetypes. You have sort of like the healers, people attracted to healing. And then you have, I guess everybody's kind of an artist, but I would say like the artists that are sort of like professional artists. Yeah. And then the engineers, builders. The builder types. Yeah. And then scientists. Mm-hmm. Lots of scientists. So what do you guys think is the overlap with these cultures? What is it about the scientists that are attracted to Burning Man, or vice versa, Burning Man that attracts scientists?
I think that it's there's a lot of work that's been done on looking at the scientist personality, I guess. And one of the things that keeps coming up is like some of the best scientists in the world are also very creative. They all have a very strong creative outlet, whether it's playing music or painting or doing something crazy. Like they all need that creative outlet in many ways. And I don't know why that is. There's something about the scientific mind that might do that. But
is creativity different than the scientific process?
No, I mean, that is part of the scientific process. Like coming up with what a good hypothesis is and making it accurate and actually fit the thing is a very creative process.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say this is one of the things that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. It feels like as artists and scientists, we're essentially doing the same thing. We're looking for ways to dissect reality. And it's just that some of us, you know, as art, you're doing it from a different perspective with different tools. And with science, you're kind of coming at it from, of course, a whole different angle. So I always, a lot of what we're trying to figure out sort of with these conversations is like, what is it that takes us out there? Like, why the desert? Why this? Why the silliness? Why the costumes?
No, there's more to the origin story. Didn't we have, wasn't it like Todd and Maggie found it on Playa? The original conversation.
There's a couple of other steps to it also. I started my involvement actually during South by Southwest, which is kind of in a lot of people's minds, a little bit of an extension of some burger community and culture aspects.
South by Southwest is, I thought it was a more music related.
It's music.
It's expanded a lot.
It's mainly interactive, is what they'll call it.
He did the quotes, listeners.
So there's all sorts of different, you know, feels people will have about these various words I'm using. Truth is that a lot of my burger friends go to it. Yeah. And part of her coming out, she knocked on my door at 3 a.m. I had no idea she was coming. Her and 6 of my other friends proceeded to pile in and sleep on my floor. You know, it was like 3 a.m, I answered to my boxers. I'm like, who are all these people? Okay, whatever. This is great. But during that time, we also wrote a grant to a group called Startup Chile, who were the first people who gave us any sort of money to support this endeavor. It really got us started. It got me out there. We ran some Megan to the country of Chile for some number of months. It was kind of a strange experience.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I imagine adventurous spirit would have to be a part of what goes with it.
Yeah. I think a lot of what's important and coming back to your earlier question a little bit, for some of these undertakings is that I think it was John Cleese, the Monty Python guy. Mm-hmm. He said one of the most important aspects of any sort of creative culture is the capacity for play. Mm-hmm. And Burning Man is definitely one of those like distinct adult play spaces insofar as there's, it's very open-ended. People come out there with projects in mind and things that they want to do and accomplish, but you know, they also have to reset a lot of those expectations in the frame of the place.
Yeah. So. We were talking about that last night.
Last night and this morning, the concept of play, what play is,
and
different ways that we play in our life. And I do believe that burners like have a unique opportunity to continue learning through their sense of play on and off Playa.
Yeah.
And through those experiences, then we get to do things that have low risk and a high reward associated with it. That's my working, one of my working definitions for what play is. Like, yeah. We get to explore things without having much cost associated with it. Mm-hmm. Burning Man provides those opportunities, mm-hmm. especially for, to go to, towards that question, what brings scientists, the science minds to the playa. It's that sense of play, that we can play with all of these ideas and combine science and art and expression, have singing Tesla coils and brain-activated brains and all these crazy things that allow us to do these forms of self-expression as play, just because.
Yeah, yeah. And I really liked your definition of play, by the way, because earlier, for the listeners, we were having this back and forth, and I was saying I think it's all play. Like, all literally, you're walking around on the street, that is play. You've decided to engage in society. You don't have to. You can just go sit in a tree like Buddha Boy. But you've chosen to play with society. And I liked Pez's breakdown was like, okay, but we're here. So we mostly agreed to be here. But so here, play is, what was it? Repeat what you were saying. It's minimum damage.
Minimum risk, yeah. High reward.
Minimum risk, high reward.
You have a little responsibility that you take on,
yeah.
But you get to play with new concepts. You can try on new personalities. You can try on new masks or faces, or try a new task. Like somebody that might typically be a healer might decide to build something, or somebody that's an engineer might decide to be a healer. And everybody can switch around and play with the different concepts for themselves.
Yeah.
And all of them serve to build that individual up, and by building individuals up, that builds the community up, and by building the community up, it ends up this wonderful cycle that we see.
So if I feel like I think it's really fun to run around with a baseball bat and hit people in the head, that's not play. That's just, I don't know, violent
just
anarchy.
A dick. Just a dick.
But if it's a foam bat, it's closer to play, but it's still kind of assault, because I'm still coming into your personal space and creating
consent
contact.
Question is a thing, but you know, like it's not harming the other people. That was one part of the other definition.
Yes,
it actually reminds me of a distinct experience I had on Playa, which was myself and my friend were wandering around Deep Playa, and a group of people all clad in black snuck up on us and unsheathed these giant flashing laser swords and mock assaulted us.
Oh my god.
So just for listeners out there, that this is totally a plausible thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure somebody was very upset about the consent issue.
They then proceeded back into the darkness and disappeared. Obviously ninjas.
Do you guys camp together?
This year we did.
Yeah.
This year
actually.
We did.
It's kind of a long and funny thing for me, because the camp we were at together was one I had been strongly associated with for a long time, though it was my first year camping with them.
How did they take it?
It was just kind of amusing. I was like, hey, everybody, Matt's a newbie this year. And I got like 6 confused emails being like, what? Is this some sort of joke?
I came to your camp. What was the name of your camp?
We're a member of the Institute Village.
Okay.
And we are the Phage.
Let's talk about Institute Village and the Phage.
Sure.
What is Institute Village and what's Phage's specialty?
The Institute has a couple of smaller camps associated with it. Relaxomats, so Relaxomatic
Plushatorium.
You guys are right on the promenade, right?
Right. Yeah. We're on
next to like BLM, by the way.
Oh yeah, that was weird.
Yeah.
BLM took a corner out of our thing, so we had to be careful. So Relaxomatic Plushatorium,
False Prophet,
and then the Phage, where our motto is we infect the playa with science.
Yeah. Okay, so what made you want to camp with Phage this year?
For me, at least, it was that I was running a fairly big project with them. Myself, Matt Faulkner, Jane, Anya Mike, and innumerable other awesome humans all put together this gigantic singing Tesla coil. Mm-hmm. So that was part of our big project this year. I'm trying to think, just people at this company involved in it include like Lyra Squirrel. We actually got one of the this guy was kind of interested in becoming an investor, ultimately didn't, but we got him to come by and help wind the coil at some point. It was kind of great. It was like totally perfect.
Nice.
You know, just a whole host of kind of fun and interesting folks that kind of all over the map came out for this. It was a big weird there's this whole like acronym in our subculture, the Big Dumb Art Project. It's like, oh, I see you've got a Big Dumb Art Project. Yeah, yeah. That's going to consume your next few months.
Yeah, yeah. That, I mean, it's especially like if it's like car related. I have no interest in having an art car. I swear, like all you do is tinker with that thing the entire 2 weeks.
So that was one of the reasons why I got into the phage in the first place. I had a friend in the phage that said, "Hey, you're doing like some brain things and EEG things. We're making this brain shaped art car. Do you want to make it be brain activated?" And I was like, "Great, that sounds amazing." It was about 2 years ago. Did the first pass in 2014, and I wasn't quite satisfied with that. So over 2015, I ended up joining the phage and took on a lead lighting role for Dr. Brainlove, is this art car. It's a 30-foot climbable steel brain, the DJ booth in the frontal lobe and dance floor in the thalamus.
That's where I found you. You were in line for the DMV.
Yep, yeah. Exactly, right.
And you were halfway not operating, by the way.
Barely throwing the last of the LEDs on. And that was...
I mean, you as a person. I mean, you were like just beaten up.
Oh, yeah, no, that was a rough time. Because it took so much time and energy for the 6 months previous just to get it to the DMV to put 15,000 LEDs on this thing and to make them, have them, all the patterns and everything else go in place and have them be neurally controlled with an EEG headset. It drained me. It was exhausting. Maddie's laughing because
I remember a distinct moment where I was feeling particularly run down working on the Tesla coil, actually, because it's a large finicky beast, and I was feeling like beat up and like what's going on? Don't feel right about this. And my co-conspirator Matt Faulkner looked me in the eye and he says, "Matt, it's a rare time in your life when you get to spend a little bit less than the median household income building a giant lightning machine." And I'm like, "Well, I forget we're playing here." His girlfriend Jane, this was her first introduction to what many people refer to as type 2 fun, which is fun only after the fact in retrospect. Where there's some level of like grueling responsibility, but there's a long-term reward you feel associated with it.
When I was pledging my frat at San Diego State, one of the big brothers is like, "It's the most fun you're never going to want to have again." But Burning Man, you keep going back to because you think in your head like, "Oh, this is what I'm going to do next year."
Totally
fix something. So back to phage real quick. So how long has the camp been around? Do we know?
Phage itself has been around for 10 years.
Wow, I thought it was like 7 or 8.
Oh, maybe. I don't know.
It was pretty new in 2010.
Are fuzzy. It's
a little fuzzy because a lot of the people who were in phage were in False Prophet beforehand.
And, which was True Prophet.
Which was True Prophet before that. Yeah. And then there's this whole... So like, what do you really call it, right? Like
this organization, the central pillar of whatever, has been around for on the order of 15 years.
If you include True Prophet in that, it's much longer, actually. Really? I had an ex-girlfriend whose father was like, "Oh yeah, I was part of True Prophet, and apparently you're sleeping next to our sound system." And I'm like, "Whoa, that's kind of weird." Hi. That was 20 years ago. Okay, gotcha.
So is True or False Prophet they're also a science camp?
Not particularly.
They have a bunch of scientists.
They had a lot of science-focused folks.
Yeah.
But phage is like, real focus in splitting out was kind of science-centric. Yeah. We've got all sorts of silly, they kind of have some science-y, they have a science-y art car, they do science-y art projects, they have Ask a Drunk Scientist is one of their other things.
What do you do? Is it really basically
it's what
title
it, it's just what it sounds
yeah,
like.
Exactly. Did I handle a scientist?
They literally they go around and deputize whoever's in camp at that time to get sloppy while answering questions.
Oh God, that's wonderful. Was it Michelle Thompson is a friend of ours. She worked on the pipe organ that San Diego brought out.
Yep.
It's pretty amazing. That thing's been at the Makers Fairs and everything. And
it's pretty intense.
Yeah. I'm worth them watching and put the whole thing together because we're building the Wonderlust Arcade next to them. And she was telling me about math camp.
Math camp sunrise. Is always at pi and e, I believe, is their coordinates.
Really?
Yes, every year.
That's
so great. Some of my first memories, I was walking around Playa, my first burn, like, oh my God, this place is crazy. There's so many different things. And I came across, stumbled across math camp.
Yeah.
People just like hanging out and looked at the whiteboard and there's just a bunch of equations up there. So I decided that was my gift. I went up and added some equations that describe action potentials.
Huh.
Just put a little, random little thing on the board, smile, and have a drink.
What are action potentials?
When neurons
when one neuron
loves another one very very much, they touch each other very gently.
Yeah.
An action potential is the signal that passes from one neuron to another. That's the binary response that like that spike of signal going from one output neuron to the next.
Yeah. So this kind of brings me back to Play, and it's so fun for me to like see like you guys get excited about this, you know, extremely nerdy shit, because I also get very excited about it. I mean, I understand only like a tenth of it, but it's really interesting to see that like you guys are here. You have this amazing work culture that is created here. Like, was this a conscious thing to design this company around the way that it is, like an open work setting? Can you talk about sort of like what went into that?
A little bit is the answer. Mm-hmm. There's some ideals of Burning Man that are really very good in terms of like cultural planning and design. Insofar as like, you know, notionally everyone's responsible for a thing. They know how to be self-reliant, all these sorts of things. There's also some elements of Burning Man that really only work in its like 2 or 3 week long context.
Yeah.
So there's some components to that.
Is there radical self-expression happening here?
Yeah, there is to some limited extent, yeah. But like by the same token.
Wednesdays.
Yeah.
We've got all sorts of silly, lovely events we do here. And a lot of what you do as a company like this to encourage folks in these cultures to join you is provide a lot of freedom and flexibility. We don't really have a vacation. We say we don't have a vacation policy. We have a communication policy, which is code for get your shit done and you won't get bothered about it.
Yeah.
But by the same token, that gets used as a stick sometimes to encourage people, you know, to finish things up. Like, you don't want to be the one that causes us to have a vacation policy. Nobody's going to like that guy. You know? Like, so like, it's kind of a weird thing, right? Because, you know, if a Burning Man project doesn't come together, it's not the end of the world. Yeah. You know, some people might be disappointed, but you know, if this project doesn't come together, there's a lot of people out of jobs and you know, it's a very different sort of feel.
Yeah.
So on one hand, like we try to embody a lot of these cultural strengths, but by the same token, you have to titrate it knowing that this is a group that has to exist in, you know, a different reality.
Yeah.
So I committed to February to looking much more sedate than I usually do. I normally have a crazy beard and blue hair, but I have to talk to a bunch of East Coast pharma guys and yeah. You know, it's a different conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah, that's it. that's one of the things that we always see. Cause like I can describe for the listeners, as I walk in, it's very open air. It's high ceilings. What was this building before? It almost looks like it's an airplane hangar. Warehouse. Okay.
There's a machine shop, and then a different kind of burner centric group actually.
Yeah.
Integrated Plasmonics.
Okay.
Had fit out a lot of it. We took it over from them actually.
Okay. Yeah. So, and then you have like this lab here that's sort of right in the front, and that one is just what, the lab? Is that what I call it?
It's lab space.
Okay.
It's notionally designed to be an air gapped clean room, mm-hmm. but we just use it as a cleaner room in the current. It's a nice containment place for all the sticky biology and keeps dust and drywall out of computers also, which is kind of nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's where you can't take your food and drink.
I would not encourage it. Yeah. You'll regret it.
Yeah. So then we come around to the other side and there's sort of like an open workspace. There's like a dinner table pretty much. There's kitchen space and people are sitting around working. Mm-hmm. Like Pez, earlier you were working upstairs and when I came back you were sitting there downstairs. Like, so it's very kind of free flowing, letting the ideas flow free. That this is all conscious decisions to make it that way.
Yes and no. We picked this space because it had a lot of open air and easy communication. The downside of that is its acoustic design is actually kind of difficult. For example, we had to replace an old coffee grinder because when it was grinding coffee, the main space was unusable. Like this was actually like a real concern for us, right? Like, it seems like a silly thing, but you know, if everyone's having a conversation or trying to figure something out and they have to stop talking for 15 seconds, you know, 4 or 5 times a day, because caffeinating 25 people takes a lot of coffee. that's a strategic problem. Yeah. So the acoustic, like the spatial design is good. The acoustic design leaves a bit to be desired. Yeah. But overall, like, I think we're generally pretty happy with this.
Far cry from the previous location.
So the previous location we were at was actually what I would refer to as a decrepit beauty school.
Yeah.
Which had some lovely charm, having black and white gaudy tile everywhere and mirrors on every wall.
Mirrors on every wall.
But the other reality was is that every crack and crevice was full of human hair. It was generally very poorly laid out for lab space.
How many employees are there here total?
Full-time, I believe, is 21.
21, 22.
It depends on how you count folks who are, like, half-time or contractor. Mm-hmm. I think our general counsel is half time. Our MD is quarter. We have a various other like smattering of folks. Like we have an accountant who I have no idea how many hours they do a week, but it's certainly seasonal.
Yeah.
Ditto. Like we have a tax related person. It's all fairly flexible and fluid. So you
were saying that you had to be a little bit more conservative looking this month to meet with the East Coast investors.
Totally. I got a bunch of crap on Tuesday for wearing a dress shirt.
a
bunch of people like saw me coming to the lab and like, "You're wearing a dress shirt.
Color? Are you okay?
Jeans." And I'm like, God, don't remind me. It's going to be okay.
So is there a conversation amongst you guys about like, because this is going to get bigger, I imagine.
Yeah. Totally. So we've actually already experienced some early pressures of this.
Of growing.
One of the upsides of having like a really awesome science-minded community is that you have like a lot of folks in it that you can draw from, both skill and expertise, advice. You know, in hiring, truthfully. But by the same token, you don't want to like limit yourself to that because you'll miss out on huge parts of the talent pool that are, you know, don't go to Burning Man. Yeah. There are plenty of interesting and talented people out there who don't.
Yeah.
Weirdos. So like, yeah, you know, weirdos.
What's wrong with them?
So a lot of what we've been experiencing recently is like, we actually hired two business guys who had never gone to Burning Man before. I think they felt a little bit on the outs and they ended up going this year.
Yeah,
it was kind of strange.
A great time. They fit in.
They did a great job. But like, we have a number of folks here.
You don't seem convinced. Are they going to go next year?
I have no idea.
They'll probably go.
I know Justin.
Justin will.
Devin's from the East Coast. We're still working on softening. He's a good one. I like him. But you know, like, there's different people with different pressures. We now have several people who have children, for example. That's like a major factor. We also have folks at, you know, different stages of life and different, you know, interests. So, we're being inclusive. So,
yeah.
And as we grow, I expect we'll have more and more people who are not from the inner community, honestly.
Yeah. So, I imagine like some of the openness and the casualness of it will start to go away.
A little bit of that just has to happen as you become a larger company. It was the four founders, I think Todd signed a lease for our first building in a towel.
Yeah.
He always wore sandals/barefoot in the lab.
Yeah.
And like, isn't that category of things where I'm like, I don't really care if Todd's barefoot.
Yeah.
I care that it sets the wrong precedent for other people. There's that whole sort of conversation that happens. Another one is purely the fact where it's like, if you don't have kind of much more traditional workplace expectations, then you're going to end up with people who become offended by particular people's behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
So like one of the realities is ultimately that you kind of, as you grow, you kind of homogenize at least a little bit. There's just a number of things that I like wouldn't even feel comfortable saying on this podcast.
Sure.
Used to do here. I'm not saying that it's a bad thing, but it's definitely a hallmark of growth.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because we've seen multiple Burner owned and founded companies go through some of these changes. And, you know, you get people storming out of there, and, oh, they've gone all corporate, you know, but I guess like you're kind of seeing that, but hey, you know, it's a part of how things grow. And I think like even Burning Man as an organization has had that experience. Like they're having to implement certain bureaucracies and
it's, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately it's a big party in the desert, so let's not dress it up too much. you know, I've talked to a number of people in various leadership levels of that. You know, there's this general attitude, which is it should have stayed the same from whenever I joined it.
Yeah.
You know, which so,
is, that's something.
This is a very, this is a very San Francisco attitude also, in my opinion, where it's like, oh my God, can you believe they let it rain this year? It didn't rain the first year I was here. And you're like, what are you talking about? Like, oh, we want to tear down this Burger King and make a condo. And I'm like, what do you care? Like, I don't know. It's kind of, there's like this bizarre, like desire for things to be stationary. Mm-hmm. And, I never fully understood that, honestly.
I mean, is that still true in the Brenner community? I mean, we don't hold, I wouldn't say that we don't hold on to the status quo. We do embrace change as it comes. We might mentally stick on the old stuff, but we still enjoy the change when it comes.
It's distinctly different, even in this short time I've been going. So I'm not saying that's good or bad. It's right. I can understand how people would feel nostalgic for what used to be.
Totally. Yeah, we've definitely heard lots of stories from people who, you're right, because I think a lot of the circles that we like to surround ourselves by tend to be the types that are like, hey, new, let's get into the new, let's see what's next. Like, it changes inevitable. But that thought process of, I don't want things to change, I mean, hell, more than half the country feels that way.
It's also one of the cornerstones of building a culture. Like, truthfully, people would be kind of upset if there wasn't a man burn.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so there's definitely some, like, very rigid artifacts that we have in our own culture that, like, let's also own up to the fact that a ton of people would be upset if we changed the dates of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, honestly, if I had to pick, I'd pick to move it over Christmas.
Yeah.
Because it would, like, coincide with all the other major religions out there.
that statement right there, which I fully agree with, by the way, not about moving into Christmas, but that it should be next to the other religions.
No, it's a lovely cult.
Yeah. It is a lot. Most Brenners don't want to admit that, but yeah. I think very much in a few kind of centuries, like,
and beliefs.
It's
also as a cult of knowledge.
Totally. In a few centuries, they'll look back and, you know, they'll be worshiping Larry Harvey. totally see that happening.
You know, I don't really see him figuring in as a personal player. Like, I think a solid half of people who go there don't know who he is.
Yeah.
Like, kind of honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, like, he's an important figure in the foundation of it, but his... I don't think anybody confuses or believes that his vision of it was what brought it to what it is.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, we're going to make this the biggest, craziest event in the desert ever. No, it's like, no, I'm just coming out here to do this thing. Like, you guys can come if you want.
Burner Podcast.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, and everything in between, taking that quick little break that we always take halfway through the show for no reason other than to, I don't know, because we keep doing it. If you want to learn more about 3Scan, I wanted to tell you guys their website is 3scan.com. That's the number 3, scan, S-C-A-N. If you don't know how to spell scan, I mean, I don't know why you're even listening to the show. 3scan.com. You can see photos of the staff and learn more about some of the projects that they're working on, well, what they can do, the technology, the real professional pitch of what 3Scan is. Go over to 3scan.com to learn more about that. We are looking for contributors to the Burner Podcast blog. We're looking forward to hearing from you. We do get emails from people from time to time from various parts of the world. Thank you to WTF Shark, by the way, who had some thoughts on the Love, Light, and Lithium episode of this very show. By the way, Love, Light, and Lithium has gotten a lot of attention. Go to the previous episodes of Burner Podcast at burnerpodcast.com and check out that one, Love, Light, and Lithium. It's our mental health roundtable. That one got a lot of buzz. Big one. If you have questions, comments, venting sessions, you know, we're always looking forward to hearing from you. And do let us know on the call if we can use your recording, if you're comfortable with us quoting you on the show. The Burner Podcast hotline is 858-877-3534. Again, that's 858-877-3534. Let's get back to Pez and Matthew with 3Scan.
Welcome home.
Yeah, it is actually very interesting to talk to a lot of, especially now, like, we're seeing this exponential increase in people coming into our community. I being one of those people, like, you're seeing that you know, that domino pattern hitting harder and harder. And most of a lot of these newer people that we meet, like, really have never really thought where it is coming from. Like, it's kind of knowledge that they start to acquire little by little.
Yeah. I think a lot of it is that, the visibility of the event has increased a huge amount. It's one of the major sources of income, the BLM, which is a federal, federal agency, not a small one either.
Yeah.
I actually felt a little bit responsible. This is a stupid, like, it's clearly not like my fault, but I put this big time lapse on the internet in 2011, and the year after was the first year that sold out super hard for the day. And I was like, you know, it got 500,000 views, right? Yeah. That's 10 times the entire city population, which means most of the people who watched it had never been to the event.
That's amazing.
So I have to imagine if like 1 in 1,000 of those people decide to go, that's like an extra 500 people, right?
Yeah.
An extra 500 people. So, you know, who knows? You never know.
Where did you set up the time-lapse camera?
It was on a nearby mountainside, actually. It's called Old Razorback. You know, it's a 2 or 3 mile hike up.
Yeah.
It's much harder with a giant lead acid battery, let me tell you. But it's funny because that was one of the first things that we kind of did as a group of friends.
Mm-hmm.
So like Todd was one of the ones, Todd actually donated a camera for that. I'm pretty sure Ted was one of the people dragging the battery up the hill with me.
Yeah.
Ted was another.
Yeah. Yeah. There's actually there's a whole bunch of cameo shots. I edited out all the pictures of people in them.
Yeah.
But like one of the first ones is me like setting up and calibrating everything. And there's like this photo of like Cody's holding this radio without a shirt and a bandana. Todd looks really confused because I don't think he knew the photo was being taken. And Ted's like, and myself, Ted,
maybe
Cody was up there.
Yeah.
So like, these are like, honestly, like I was taking the photo, two of the other, yeah, so basically two of us were like founders of this company. One of them was the first employee. Sorry, three of us were founders of this company and one of them was the first employee. So I was like, that's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
It does not feel like a complete coincidence anymore.
Oh, and I've given up with thinking about coincidences.
Yeah.
Way too many synchronicities. I've had my weird synchronicity today was my friend Myra said that Saturday night we're going to go bananas, left that on my Facebook page. And for some bizarre reason, that word just kept staying in my head. Just would not
bananas,
go away.
Bananas
would not go away.
Bananas.
Today, I just happened to, I don't know, like have a photo at Doris Park. And our friend Cable just messages me totally out of nowhere.
He's like,
the safe word is bananas. I'm like, what? And then I asked him, like, it's crazy. That word's been on my mind. He hasn't responded. He just randomly felt the urge to send. He doesn't know Myra. He's completely come out. Weird fucking bringing that shit. So for the time lapse, explain for us how that works. You went to a mountain and you set up a camera. What goes into that?
It was probably my first Burning Man project, mm-hmm. if you want to think about it that way. Certainly, like the most visible one.
How'd you get the idea?
This was actually there was two kind of progenitors of it. One was Todd, and the other was this guy we refer to as Dr. Dave, who was an MD PhD. And they had they had put together some sort of wager that if you looked at the map, the Burning Man pixel was the one with like the highest standard deviation or something like that. Because, like, right. Most of the year it's totally, like, black. Like,
yeah.
There's nothing out there. But then, like, there's this one week of, like, LEDs everywhere and fire and explosions, right? So, like, if you were looking at this from space, you'd be really confused by this pixel.
Yeah.
It's kind of the notion.
Yeah.
And so we're like, well, why don't we take pictures of this? It's interesting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, honestly, it was really lucky that the project worked at all.
Yeah.
I gave a presentation after. It's like 15 things not to do when running a time lapse.
Okay.
And like the enclosure we had for the camera like didn't work. So I had brought this backpack up with me, which was like this clear raver backpack from Walmart. And I cut a hole in the side of it and used medical tape to tape it around the lens.
Oh, wow.
The solar panel we had dragged up there was held. So we brought an extension cord because we thought we would have to put the panel for that further apart, but we didn't. So we then butchered the extension cord to tie down the solar panel. Like all the voltage regulators for the camera and for the intervalometer were like these like floating dead bugs with these like resistors and capacitors and junk hanging off of them.
How do you keep dust off the lens?
I hiked up there. And so that was one of the other failures is I used this iFi card, which notionally had unlimited memory because it would downlink the images through the wireless we had up there.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing it doesn't say in the documentation is it'll only delete them locally when you power cycle the camera.
Okay.
So after the camera stayed on for a week, it stopped uploading images one day, and I'm like, I guess I'm driving to Reno. Let's do this.
And you're living in here?
I was back in San Francisco. We had gone out 2 weeks early and set it up.
How long? Is it recorded 5 weeks?
It was a total of 5 weeks. Okay. The card filled up. It turned out every 10 days or so.
Okay.
So,
but how does that card fill up? It uploads,
but it doesn't delete them unless you power cycle it.
Oh, interesting.
So I literally just had to go up there and like switch the camera off, switch the camera back on, and then like do that a couple of times, and I would just delete them all. It's kind of like, well, that's stupid.
So it's almost like backing it up more than anything.
Yeah. It was slightly funny.
How many times is it taking a photo?
Let me see if I can remember the math on this. I think it was every 6 minutes, which gave you 10 times an hour, so 240 photos a day.
Okay.
Times, what is that? 5 weeks times 7, 35. It was some thousands of photos.
Yeah. And you recorded for 5 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. It turned out very lovely, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big pile of photos. They're all up on the internet. You can go check them out.
Yeah.
Just search it down. It's fun.
What,
it was kind of fun, actually. Like, it was kind of my introduction to the community in a lot of ways, also.
Yeah. That's one hell of an introduction.
Totally. It was great.
I show up with a reporter.
Yeah. It was really fun, though, because then I got, like, all these weird inbound emails, and I was like, hey, I'll do a Kickstarter for some hardware to do something crazy next year. And it was funny, because, like, I just sold photos, right? I was just like, $5, I'll mail you a photo to anywhere on Earth.
Wow.
And like, it was hilarious because we ran this whole Kickstarter and like just barely broke even. Yeah. Got like a couple $100 worth of like random camera equipment for me and some of the other collaborators. And the project we tried to put together the next year was just such a dismal failure. It was hilarious. It was much more like the first one deserved to be, honestly. The second one was really carefully planned and put together way ahead of time. It just didn't work.
Yeah. And the other sometimes one, the magic, like you don't get to plan it too ahead of time.
Right.
Totally.
That's specifically the reason that I explain to people why I don't prepare for interviews. Have you guys had any experiences where you're already working, you have the company going and everything, but then you're out there either in the desert or one of the regional events or something, mm-hmm. and an idea for something sparks and it affects the direction of the company?
I've had a couple of those. Honestly, a lot of what I spend time out there doing is not thinking about some of these problems.
Sure.
But
it's usually like we do know, like a lot of times when we walk away from a problem, that's when the solutions pop up.
Doing some subconscious processing, I got a lot more thoughts when it came back than when I was there.
Yeah. I distinctly get what I feel like is a performance and creativity bump substantially after the event, where it's like, I've learned all these new and disparate things. I've talked to a lot of people about stuff I wouldn't normally be exposed to. I have different sets of connections than I used to. Frankly, I just got out of my own head for a long time. Spent some time thinking about a lot of other things.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's kind of the best mix of like vacation and gathering some of the smartest people you ever meet into the same place. So like, I don't think I could find a conference to go to that I'd find more educational. Really kind of an unusual thing to say.
Because I know like Pixar, for example, they still spend time doing like their own little cartoons that they don't release. Just like something different.
Pixar is a great case study, actually. They've got another structure they call Notes Day. I'd encourage anyone listening to read Ed Catmull's book about this. It's called Creativity Inc. It's a fantastic read about how to build a creative culture. We co-opted a bunch of stuff from it secretly.
That's awesome.
So if you're not smart, just find somebody smarter than you and copy what they did,
For sure. I mean, if why keep reinventing the wheel if somebody's got some sort of thing figured out? Because I have a lot of experience with government, and it's like the complete opposite. Government is like, no, you stay within the parameters of what you're supposed to do. Like, even if you're working as any sort of creative field for government, it's expected that you show up at 8 a.m. and you start being creative till 5 p.m. and then you take that 1 hour lunch break, and we just know over and over that the brain simply just doesn't work that way. And it's so that's a lot of the stuff that I've been hoping to explore more of, is like how the culture is affecting how we operate in mainstream society.
Interesting. So here, for example, we don't have really set hours. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, we don't have any set hours, but kind of truthfully, if you aren't here between 11 and 4, I think people would be a little weirded out by that. Yeah. That being said, we have a couple of people who have distinctly different schedules. You know, Ted routinely wanders in here around noon, but you know, like what, it's coming up on 8, right? And he's still cranking it downstairs. Yeah. So I kind of, not surprised by that.
Yeah.
Every morning people come in at like 7.
My God, Mills gets here at like 6:30 or something like that after taking the ferry from Vallejo. So I don't even know how she does that.
is there science behind that that you guys are aware of? Or, I don't know if there's science, but I mean, there's like research behind that about different people having different hours of productivity in a day.
There's been some work on that. I mean, a lot of it, I think at least here, a lot of it depends on the individual requirements for time. Like Mills has a family, so she goes home after work and spends time with family, with her kid and whatnot. There's that classic graph of famous minds and their wake and sleep schedules.
Yeah.
And you look at them and there's some people that wake up like 5 in the morning and like do a little bit of exercise and then start writing by 6 and then like go to sleep at 7 p.m. or whatever that is. And some people that wake up at noon, you know, have a fifth of vodka and like then that gets creative juices flowing. They still stay up to like 4 in the morning writing or whatever that is.
Yeah.
Everybody has their own different mechanisms for it. It's like trying to ask you if you're a night person, right?
Generally.
Do you have a hard time waking up in the morning?
Very hard time,
right?
However,
it's trainable. You can.
Yeah.
Will you still be like productive if you do that?
So I'm very conflicted on that answer because I've gotten more into like morning workouts in the past year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my whole life I didn't run. Like, it was just bad. My body size and my knees and everything. It was just my physical therapist was like, no, if you ever fucking run, I will hit you with a stick. I started to when I got involved with the November Project, which is this whole thing. You guys have a chapter of it here in San Francisco as well. I was considering going tomorrow. I found that when I do wake up in the morning and push myself, like, it's pretty fucking beautiful.
You tend to have to push.
Yeah.
Like, I love the mornings that I wake up, like, early and then go exercise and do yoga or climb and then come in to work. And, like, I feel great.
Yeah.
It feels great. I don't know. I don't have a good estimate on how that affects my productivity. I'm sure that there's science there, but I don't know what the primary literature says.
Well, I guess here's what the key factor is. When we're doing that,
exercise is good.
Of course. It's been good for the brain. Like that's what a lot of very intelligent people don't like pay attention to that. Like it's good for your productivity. Yeah. It's good for your focus. But I guess the difference is that it has to be a choice. If you're told you must be here at 8 a.m.
yeah.
and then you have to squeeze it into 6 a.m., you're being passive aggressive to yourself and finding
totally.
A way to like fuck up your day.
Sure. Totally.
This actually speaks a lot to part of my creative process is that one of the major facets to it is I can't have like dictation on the expected outputs.
Mm.
So anytime I'm having like a creative day in which I'm like trying to go and do some side project, I don't have like a firm time on which I'm going to start or stop.
Yeah.
In fact, I find those things to be the most destructive things to it. Insofar as like, if I'm feeling in the flow of it, I might just keep working on it till 2 or 3 in the morning. You know, if I'm not feeling it, I might go home early and do something, you know, less creatively centric. And both of those are like okay outcomes. I just can't like place the expectation on myself.
Yeah.
So actually having a lot of the time bounds, I think, is one of the bigger discouragers in a way. And I mean, there's all sorts of other dimensions in which you can restrict people that interfere with this. But I think time is one of the biggest ones. Another fine example, I keep coming back to John Cleese. He's got this really fantastic YouTube video on his creative process. And one of the things he lists is like time. Like you just need to have some time to do it. Like you can't expect to happen in like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Also like space, some sort of space that's like free from the day to day, free from the, you know, moment to moment thing. You feel like you need to be doing the to-do list, the satisfaction and little bumps you get from doing all these tiny things. It has to be kind of open-ended and unstructured, I think. That's a big piece of it.
Yeah, I had a friend of mine who got his PhD from University of North Carolina, and then he got into cancer research. And he was describing a lot of the stuff that they were working on, and he was saying that at the end of the day, like, your brain was like physically exhausted. Can you guys speak on that subject?
Yes.
Like, you're just tired of thinking, you want to watch something dumb.
I mean, that was yesterday. I was I'm a biologist, neurobiologist by training, and I do a lot of computer programming, but like, there's some things that make my brain just tired. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to do this recursive algorithm, looking at different contours for the images and trying to solve this thing. And I got it, and it was great. And I got home by the end of the day and just like crashed out. My brain was just shut off. I could not do anything else for the rest of the day. It felt great. Like, I nailed the thing while I was working on it, but it just took everything that I had for the day.
I distinctly segment my workflows into the creative and creation moments, mm-hmm. where I have like maybe 2 hours of that a day. Then there's like another 4 to 6 hours of like email, project management, like tidying up code, figuring out, writing documentation, all these things that are like absolutely important, but don't require as much like deep thought. And if I kind of keep myself to that sort of schedule, when I get home at the end of the day, my lovely girlfriend Lonnie will like ask me questions, and she'll be like, this and that, and this and that. And I'll just kind of like stare at her confused. And she's like, you need a sandwich and a glass of water and maybe a nap.
Yeah.
We'll discuss things after that.
It is a muscle.
It is a muscle
that gets tired. Totally.
Yeah. And the only thing I can describe that satisfies me during those times is, I had one friend refer to it as white noise.
Yeah.
So, silly, lighthearted things that you don't have to like process deeply. A great example of this is like Adventure Time, the little tiny TV show. It's kind of ADD and spastic, but it's cute and funny and not too hard and easy to process. Before I heard that term, the one I'd used is brain chewing gum.
Brain chewing gum.
Just something you can just kind of like mash back and forth in there, and it doesn't really require any like, why are you satisfied by chewing gum? It's like, well, it doesn't really speak to me at a soul level. It just kind of does this thing.
Feels good. Because chewing gum is actually like one of those like lower your anxiety tricks, going into a situation where if you're worried, you can chew some gum. Mm-hmm. For me, sometimes I just get really aggressive though. And I'm just like, I'm keep chewing this fucking thing and it won't go away. It's just like, it's I don't know. Funny. It can backfire.
Are you an angry yoga person also?
When I initially started with yoga, I was. But then after I got into meditation...
Downward dog!
Yeah. Fucking warrior two, get hold of my knee hurts. I do love yoga now. Mm-hmm. But that was, I had to figure out the other part of it first. But what are a couple of the things that you guys are like going through scans right now? I know there was the mouse gut.
The first thing I was like looking for is like, where's my computer? I could just find this out. I didn't bring it with me.
Nobody can see it anyway.
It's fine. I think we've got an octopus brain.
Yeah, we're doing an octopus brain right now.
Who requested the octopus brain?
That's a collaborator we have at Texas A&M. We've got a project for some folks at Baylor University.
Mm-hmm.
Doing the tumor segmentation on that.
Yeah, we're doing some subcutaneous tumors. That's kind of cool.
They grow the tumors under a mouse and then see if a drug reduces the tumor.
Oh, wow.
Trying to make sure that our tech works well for that kind of stuff. That's one of the projects that I'm heavily involved in right now, is processing that data.
So they remove the tumor and send it to you?
So they they remove the skin with the tumor and send it to us, and then we do our stain and put that into
slice it up and image it.
Slice it up and get a bunch of pixels and then hand it to me.
how many things... So does an image of that... Has an image of that existed prior to you doing this?
So you can definitely find cross sections.
Mm-hmm.
So again, if you take the kind of standard technique, you'll cut like a big kind of thick slab of tissue, kind of like 20 to maybe even 100 microns thick.
Yeah,
it's kind of like really thin deli meat is the way to think about it.
Yummy.
Yeah, and I mean, like when you do that, you have some idea of what the cross section of an animal's muscle look like.
Yeah.
Kind of factually, right? Similarly, if you do that with an apple, you can see like these little cavities where seeds were, where the body of it is, where the skin is.
God, I'm never going to be able to eat a mortadella sandwich again. Thinking about a mouse tumor.
Yeah, yeah. So it's the same thing, but the slices are on the order of 2 or 3 microns.
Mm.
Which, to give you a feel,
human hair is 40 microns.
Human hairs are 50. Big. Red light is like a half micron. Just to give you a feeling, like photons are kind of down there. So like some of the smallest cells you'll see out there, what, like 2 or 3 micron, excepting some really weird exotic stuff, like those little microbes and other ants. Yeah. Bugs are super weird. Don't mess with bugs. then, you know, just, you know, take it apart, pretty fine scale. And
take it's a lot amazing. Of so it's like, you know, like in a, you're watching, I don't know, X-Men.
Sure.
And they have a scene where like they're bringing up the hologram and, you know, opening the body up and taking this organ out and moving this thing. I don't think that happens in X-Men. I'm trying to think of what movie I saw that in recently with the 3D images. But
in Fifth Element, they regrew.
Yeah. They did the 3D printing type
thing. That's 3D printing.
Yeah, right? Yeah. 3D
imaging.
I don't think that word existed when that movie came out.
No. No. Chris Tucker's career didn't yet either. But yeah, so you guys are creating these things that will be used in situations like that. Like somebody could theoretically, with the right VR capability, like hold it up in front of them, look inside the tumor.
Yeah, yeah, that's the goal.
Spin it around, send it over to the next guy on the Microsoft desk, or whoever makes the desk. Yeah. That is absolutely amazing. And it's, again, like it's... and all of this stuff is going to be... kept in records, and we'll be able to access it. And what that's going to do is it will increase the speed of us being able to solve health challenges.
Absolutely.
So one of the kind of like theses that people have been throwing around in terms of like drug discovery and even like just general improvement and better understanding of biology is that we've solved all the problems you can solve collecting very small amounts of data.
Yeah.
If you could just, you know, find something out about people with a survey or some sort of very low fidelity sort of measurement, like how tall you are. We've mostly sorted that out.
Yeah.
Then, you know, people were like, okay, well, we've got all these chemical assays and we can survey you for hundreds of compounds and, you know, measurements of this and your genetics. And that's kind of like moving up the scales in a certain way. You're collecting more and more data and you're, you know, we've had tons of discoveries as a result of that. We have a great inspiration for how a lot of these diseases work now. But there's a lot of stuff out there that are like very complex multi-system failures, like autism, like Alzheimer's, for example. Like almost all the neurodegenerative diseases, they have some idea of what happens, but they don't really have a good feeling of how or why. And this is really dissatisfying because we've spent literally human lifetimes of effort on it and billions of dollars researching them. And we don't still have a good feeling.
Yeah.
So one of the core theses of this company is that as you're able to collect more and more information about morphology, structures, tissues, cells and organs, really, we should be able to learn more and more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's it's interesting like to look at where we're all going as a society as a whole. The friend of ours, Dave Cox in San Diego, I don't know if you know him, he worked on the Wonderlust project, but he's working on a system that we could best describe as like the Google Maps of the sewer system, like sewer and water and pipes. So he's describing like how it works. And it's some of what you were telling me earlier about bouncing light off and getting the image and explain that, by the way, so I can't repeat it. How the system works.
The machine actually works.
Yeah.
So we have the block of tissue embedded in something that holds it steady, like paraffin or resin, like epoxy. Okay.
It basically looks like a little ice cube.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Right?
That's what the tissue
is. So the tissue, like say like a mouse brain is in the middle of that block.
Yeah.
We put
it's the
that,
cutest little brain you'll ever see.
we put that block under the microscope where we have a diamond knife that does the slicing. The diamond knife is illuminated from the back with fiber optics. So as the knife slices along the top of the block, the whatever that slice is illuminated from the knife itself, and the slice comes off. There's an objective optics above it that focus on that point of the knife edge and image that slice as it comes off, and then digitizes that with a camera and then sends that to computers and then we save that data.
Yeah.
As we slice it.
So as of now, it's not possible to do that without actually cutting through the tissue?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. This is a reverse 3D printing.
Yeah.
Is one way to think about it.
Yeah.
There are some techniques out there that will get you a little ways in.
Mm-hmm.
If you do a lot of work, for example, like 2-photon is a type of microscopy out there, and it's distinguished by allowing you to illuminate a plane of light and then very carefully like dig deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
And what they consider is deep imaging is like a millimeter.
Yeah.
And with this technology, we're routinely doing like multi-centimeter long samples, so like tens of times longer and wider.
Crazy.
So really, it's because like if you know you look at your tiny little piece of tissue, it just looks like a ball of flesh.
Yeah.
Right. And you can't really like photons do not help you tell what's inside of it. You can't like hold it up to a light bulb and find something out about it.
The reason I brought up Dave Koss is the thing that he's working on. He's not actually, because the way that his system works, my very limited basic understanding, or the system that has worked historically, is you want to go build a building. Okay, you got to go get all these permit codes. You have to see where the water hookup is, the sewage, the sewers, all this stuff. Apparently, we don't have a map of all of that because it was done a couple hundred years ago.
Yeah, over the last 200 years.
Yeah.
As needed.
No fucking idea where most of the water pipes and sewage are, which was mind-blowing to me. So what we do is we shoot a laser down into it, and that bounces off all the walls and
some sort of acoustic technique.
Yeah.
Ultrasound.
Not photon specifically.
Yes. But so what he's working on is basically creating a mapping system that can map like all of it out.
Totally.
And so you can pull up a Google map of what's underneath the ground the same way that you
12-inch water main right here.
Yeah, exactly. And that right there is going to cut, let's say, a few months into how long it would take normally to build that high rise in downtown. Now it'll go up even faster.
Interesting.
And so it's kind of like similar, like what you guys are doing over here. The information that you're collecting eventually will be part of a larger data set that is going to save people time from healing faster as well.
That's a goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this is the part that I wanted, like, we're going to get very like philosophical on. So I was present for a DMT trip with a very beautiful young lady, by the way, who had really amazing experience. And she was a pro, by the way. She'd had multiple trips. I mean, she kind of woke up halfway and said more. Like, she was like, she took it longer. And so she goes further in and she ends up on a spaceship that flies out on a flying saucer.
Like you do.
Yeah, like you do. And there's multiple entities on this flying saucer. And one of them, she said, seemed like a masculine entity and is showing her out the window the Earth. And she said, it's this beautiful, gorgeous, magnificent thing. It's blue, it's green. Like, it's the most amazing thing you can imagine. And he says, come with me here. And they walk to another window and they look down and it looks like the fucking Death Star. There's fire shooting off. It's all metal. It's covered with, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so she says, why are you showing this to me? And she said that he looks very confused. He didn't understand. He's like, I don't know what happened. Like, I gave you, I set it up and then this is what it turned into. And so like what I was looking at, like with what Dave Cox is working on, and you guys are kind of working on like the other side of the spectrum, the healing side of it, is that we're all working as these cogs in this massive machine that is society throughout history. Is there any way to stop getting to the Death Star? I mean, it just feels like that's sort of inevitable. Like, we're moving in that direction no matter what we do. So we're going to live forever and we're going to build more shit and we're going to cover up the Earth.
So, let me start by putting my cards fully on the table.
Please do.
And say that I'd vote for the first president who supported the Dyson Sphere. You don't know what that is. It's a construction which surrounds the sun in order to capture all of its energy.
Okay.
And I think this is generally believed to be one of the hallmarks of a truly advanced civilization, is that their sun disappears.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to capture more of it to do more work.
Uh-huh.
And one of the fundamental endeavors of humankind is the generation of entropy. We are tiny little engines which create novel and tiny and exquisite experience. Mm. And I think that's one of the best things we can aspire to as a culture. And fundamentally, Burning Man epitomizes some of this. It's like, let's make all the entropy right here.
Yeah.
Let's bring all these externalities together into this bizarre cacophony of absolute insanity.
Yeah.
if you were picked up and kidnapped from anywhere on Earth and dropped in the middle of this, you would be so disoriented, in my opinion, to wonder if these people were still on the same Earth that you were.
Totally.
Which I think is a really excellent design goal, for an art project, at least. That's one of my major design goals, is like, when people see this, do they believe it can be real? So like, that's a big endeavor, I think, of both our culture and I think largely our civilization eventually.
Yeah. And we're contributing to that, though. We're all, there's no way to stop it.
It's not even a negotiation.
Yeah,
you can't shape the direction, though, right? Yeah. So, I mean, we there is no fixed trajectory given where we're going. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about this with other friends as well. Like, you can create intention at the cultural level and have multiple cultures that can shape. Yes, this direction we want to go towards a utopia, not the dystopia.
Yeah.
It's hard. You're fighting entropy. You're fighting a lot of these different things. I mean, entropy will be a part of both sides in the classic concept of entropy. But it needs to be a conscious decision on a lot of different bases to have that utopian view of the direction of society, as opposed to just eating ourselves alive, which we're doing very well.
We're very good at that. It feels like what we're seeing a lot of is just communities tribalizing further and further. Everybody's pulling, because you have methods of communication that's helping me see, like, you know what? I don't want to move to that neighborhood. It's a bunch of Republicans that live there. I don't want to talk to my neighbor if that apartment over there. nothing against our Republican listeners, but it's just giving you an example. Like, it used to be that you live on a block and, you know, you're all the neighbors, like, let's say you all work at the steel mill, and some guy's conservative, then the next door neighbor is more liberal, and it's kind of the same community, though. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, like, you pretty much decide where you're going to live because you already know exactly where you're going to live, and we're further and further pulling aside. And a perfect example of it is this presidential election with Bernie and Trump. They really are they couldn't be more perfect.
Right. Yeah.
Opposites. If it was a fucking Shakespeare play, it's amazing. And there's that direction we're still moving in, and what you guys are creating here and what is happening. I don't know what the answer is. I just think it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating that these are discussions that that are probably being had in your off time. Yes. Meanwhile, you show up to work the next morning and you create a mascot.
So I do think entropic creation is still one of the undertakings, no matter what party you're a part of. Even folks in the Green Party are saying, like, we are trying to maintain this environment and this ecosystem. And, like, these are complex and beautiful things, and they require energy, and I think we should keep them around.
Yeah.
That's kind of my belief in that matter. It's like, well, you know, a lot of people more on the Republican end of things are like, we should, you know, have a lot of oil and gas rights. We should have a lot of energy and, you know, cheap and easy goods. It's in a lot of ways the same goal. Mm-hmm. Similarly, a lot of people in the more, democratic end of things are much more focused on some social issues and, like, you know, personal freedoms and all that. Those are also entropic outcomes. They're freedoms and capacities, and it's permutation space, and they take thought and energy.
Yeah.
So I think a big part of what we're trying to do as a culture is just figuring out what trajectory we take through. And that's hard.
Yeah.
It's real challenging.
I think we're doing that subconsciously. I mean,
yeah,
culture shapes itself subconsciously. There is a hive mind to a culture, right?
Yeah.
And there's this subconscious desire towards a goal. And the culture itself can shift towards that goal without necessarily being aware that they're shifting towards that.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that happens all the time. just even on a personal level.
Yeah.
You know, here I was thinking, like, I'm so counterculture and, like, I'm not going to get married and all this bullshit. And fucking 34 comes around, I'm immediately thinking about, like, it's already showing up in my whatever journey I went through. I thought it was completely different than everybody else, but somehow it ended up being on the same schedule. So have you... I'm wondering if you've faced any moral decisions as far as, like, what you will and won't do as a company based on what you're contributing to the future of society.
Whew, that's a heavy one. definitely yes is the answer.
Mm.
Specific embodiments are a little harder to come up with that are non-disclosive in a way.
But you've crossed some paths where
there's some choices you make where you're like, a company that makes genetic crops approached us. There's hundreds of those out there. And they wanted to characterize X or Y. you know, it's fundamentally, it's a biological tissue. And the truth is that, like, that's a thing we know how to do. It's a thing we can probably even do pretty well. And we're like, sure, we'll do that. We're going to contribute to the knowledge of the world, even if you're going to keep it secret and silo it and maybe use it against other people. But there's some, like, element of knowledge creation still that's unique to this culture.
Yeah. Would you, have you ever said no to somebody?
Mainly because we thought our technology wasn't a good fit for them. There's been a couple of times where somebody's like, hey, can you like do some image analysis for us? And we're like, we do that for our own data sets and we have unique advantages in that space. Like, there's a lot of people who do that. You should go find somebody else who's better suited. There's been people who've come to us and been like, can you do teeth? Right? Like, somebody was actually like, can you put these human teeth in your microscope? I'm like, probably not. Is the answer. I mean, like,
good,
but yeah, diamonds are pretty solid, but their teeth are ceramics and they'll get all screwed up. And, you know, like, maybe we can, like, decalcify it. We, like, tried to work a couple things out, but we never did it. Also, like we can't do, like, cell culture, right? Like, we've got a loose pile of cells. That's, like, not really what we do. You know, traditional microscopy techniques will get you really far with that. Yeah. So, like, there's been tons of situations where it's, like, this tech isn't what you're looking for. What we do here just, like, isn't quite right for you, and that's okay.
Can you imagine somebody you'd say no to based on moral grounds?
Right? Yeah, totally. I'm having a hard time coming up with a specific example, to be truthful.
Yeah.
Really what we do is take in a piece of matter and provide you some information about it.
Sure.
There's very little, in my opinion, morality associated with that. Mm-hmm. It's like, if, you know, just to make it very tangible, it's like, would a surveyor ever be in a situation where they could be doing something immoral, right? It's like, well, find a rectangle this big over that way. Yeah. And you're like, well, I don't really even know what you're doing with this. That's kind of like not my department. And like, you know, like maybe they're building a death camp or maybe they're building, you know, a new sewer system or whatever it is. But like in a certain way, we're like kind of disconnected from a lot of those issues because we're really just trying to provide a meter stick.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. That's interesting.
Information pipe.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of funny. Our business is actually like a reverse assembly line. Like most businesses like buy some series of parts, they carefully assemble them, integrate them and provide documentation around it and then provide that built unit to a person. And then that person pays them money. In our case, the person provides us the object. We carefully take it apart into 1,000 pieces and send them back the idea of it. And then they pay us money for that. So it's a little bit of an unusual business so far as it's not a physical goods purveying, right?
Now, does that information, what you map, that does that belong, is that proprietary knowledge of that company or does it?
It depends. We've actually got different, we've got different scales of licensing which will apply. So if you are, you know, giant pharma company X, and you want to be the only person who ever sees this, the only person who ever touches it, and not even included in our own internal analysis for like process control and improvement, we actually charge a lot more for that. Because a lot of the value we harness from or harvest from this technology is like being able to co-opt data sets together. So basically, since we get a lot less utility out of doing your project, we expect to pass that cost along. Similarly, if
there's a mine tax.
So if you're if you're a tiny researcher and you just want to, you know, image something very small, and you want to be able to make that data set public and available, we'll have like a much more conservative pricing associated with that, where it's like you are contributing to our technology because you're going to go out there and write papers and say, then I did this technique that 3Scan did, and here's the data from that. And that's something that kind of builds us up in both reputation in the science community and also like, you know, their friends and colleagues are going to read this and be like, oh yeah, that's kind of cool. That seemed really easy and that was cheap for him. So I'm really going to do that. So it's so definitely...
Where are you guys going next? What is sort of the next chapter?
That's a hard question. The early answer is we've got our microscope kind of running now. in some capacity, meaning we can kind of put an arbitrary piece of tissue in there and get some sort of imagery out. There's like a lot of process optimization to be done to get that like really tight and beautiful. That's kind of a predictable answer, honestly. But eventually we're going to add more and more and more products that sit on top of that in a way.
Yeah.
So right now, one of the first things we did was focus on vasculature. That's something we did pretty well. That's relevant to a lot of cardiovascular studies, a lot of immune studies, and mainly like cancer-related studies. And so there's a bunch of early customers we have kind of in that space. Another one that's a little bit more clinical-facing is this stained pair called hemotoxin and eosin, which basically anytime you pull a chunk of human tissue out of somebody, the first thing they'll do is take a couple of slices and dump it through hemotoxin and eosin. So that's one of the next things we've been working on.
Which does what now?
It stains gigantic categories of features, honestly. Okay. Like, I guess eosin sticks to nuclei.
Eosin sticks to nuclei, mostly the charged DNA, and hemotoxin.
Sticks to, so like, basically anything acidophilic and, like, a bunch of other stuff.
Everything else.
It's, like, it's kind of a good general contrast agent, and it's also a bit of a standard in the industry.
Okay.
So, like, we're doing some imaging in that space. There's a whole other thing we've been talking about where, like, if you get a mole removed, mm-hmm. something that they think is mildly cancerous, there's this toluidine fast blue.
Oh, yeah.
Toluidine. I forget the...
Toluene? One of the dyes.
There's literally hundreds of, like, potential stains out there for us to investigate and do imagery work with. So that's kind of like the short answer. The longer answer is that, the longer term answer, I guess I should be clear, is that we're going to be moving towards doing human histology and pathology work. So right now it's like almost all like tiny little one-off research projects.
Yeah.
Next we move into like, large pharma research, preclinical research. Then we move into like CLIA labs and some like early human trial type stuff. Mm. And then slowly but surely we have tried to take more and more human imagery and kind of, displace the current technique for that.
Yeah, that's powerful.
So, yeah, it's a long game, but
it's
hard.
You're going to need a bigger microscope.
Oh, man. So, like, we've already got 12 on order.
Yeah.
Nice. And they're about 4 or 5 times faster than what we have here. Yeah. So, we're going to do our best to bury Mike and Data.
Amazing.
He'll be quicksanding his way through. Oh, stop.
Just for a quick concept of how big the data is that we need to go through, you know, I think your phone camera takes like 8 to 10 megapixel. That's
Fuck, are we 10, already at that?
I mean, six to ten. Yeah. It's somewhere in that range. Like that's megapixels per image. A movie that you download takes about 600 megabytes. Byte is about the same as a pixel for what we're doing. Mm-hmm. That gut image that you saw, the three-dimensional render of that gut.
Of a mouse gut.
Of the mouse gut was about 1 terabyte. 1 terapixel. 1 teravoxel, because it's three-dimensional. That's 1 trillion.
Oh, 1 × 10⁹.
Yeah. No.
Megagig. 12. 1 × 10⁻¹ pixels.
Yeah.
That's not our largest data set either.
And that's not the largest data set.
That's about a third of that data set. It's like 6 or 7 teravoxel. So, you know, it's hard to explain to people that, like, we take a 90 megapixel image every, like, 2 or 3 seconds per machine, and then we run those as much as possible. So, like, a lot of our early effort was just surrounding, like, how do you move that data around? It turns out it's kind of complicated.
There's a lot of data.
So.
Imagine there's a lot of servers with a lot of fans.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Short answer, yes.
Wow, that's insane. Guys, thank you so much. It's been really fascinating.
Sure.
You guys going to burn this year?
Thinking about it. Still undecided yet.
Yeah.
I have unfinished projects that I want to go back and do, and at the same time, you know, travel is also nice.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm right now, I mean, I'm still at a place where I'm like, fuck, I've gotten more out of a week at the burn than I did like all of Europe.
Fair enough.
More shit.
True.
More connections come out of it. You going?
For me, I have a lot of friends across the U.S., many of which centralized for that event.
Yeah.
So it's really hard for me to turn it down from a social standpoint only.
It's kind of a family reunion.
Yeah, it's like family reunion. I was honestly a little bit bummed this year because my my proposal got turned down for my Big Dumb Art project.
Oh.
But it's okay. We'll do a smaller scope of it, and it'll be great. I just want to do a proof of concept for next year, making it super crazy.
Sure, well.
Yeah, I'm not worried about it.
Well, hopefully, you know, I'll see you guys, and we'll dance on the brain.
Totally.
Sounds good. In the old desert.
just have to show up with only the 10-foot Tesla coil. Yeah.
No problem.
No big.
No pressure.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for being here.
Hey, it's the end of it there. What a wonderful show. Stay tuned for next week's interview with Iris from Burning Man HQ. You can tweet me directly at Mr. Arash. That's M-R-A-R-A-S-H. And when discussing the show, please do use the hashtag Burner Podcast. You can also catch me on the Crappy Awesome Podcast. That is a weekly interview show and a staple in the independent hip-hop community for like 5 years now. Find that over at platformcollection.com. Shows are up on Libsyn and SoundCloud first, and then eventually they end up on iTunes and on TuneIn.com and on Spreaker and Stitcher, a variety of other platforms that you can listen to. Make sure you check out all of those various places and do leave us some reviews. That helps us get the more exposure for the show and keep this free show going for you. That would be very, very nice of you. Our intermission music is by Duckman. Check out his music over at DuckmanSD, like San Diego, .bandcamp.com. And if you're a musician in the community, tweet your music over to our music editor at I Am Navjeet. The Burner Podcast theme song is America's Force with No Name Remix, produced by Joman. Check out his stuff over at soundcloud.com/DJ Joman. This episode is produced by Meg King. If you have questions or suggestions for future guests, shoot them over to Meg King. She is on Twitter at @ThatMegKing. Our online editor is Tanasi. He does write and curate the blog, burnerpodcastblog.com. You can reach him by shooting him a message at burnerpodcast.com. Hope you will join us next time. We do release new episodes on the first and third Wednesdays of the month. So until next time, love and light and all that other crap. Good night.